Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hey, everybody, it's me, Justin Robert Young.
And Brian Brushwood.
Stealing my bit. Singing. That was too close to a song.
No. I got you. I got you, buddy.
I had the mojo. I lost it. Now I'm just a talking fool.
So first off, if you all have a project, something you want us to talk about, please feel free to send it to us at go ahead and send it to neshcom@gmail.com. Subject line After Things, and we love to talk about this stuff. And you know, we're all trying to figure things out and working over, you know, talking about what your project, what you're up to, and you know, blending in our own two cents. And admittedly, you know, we're first ones to tell you that some of our ideas are idiotic and some of our criticisms are unfounded. You know, we're just a bunch of self-loathing people.
But seriously, don't underestimate the value of sending in ideas to us. We really love those as jumping off points.
Yeah. I want to share something with you guys, which is sort of kind of a very slow epiphany perhaps for me. And I was at in LA periodically, there's a show called Brookledge Follies, which is this kind of a variety show. It's held at the Brookledge, which is this theater in the back of the mansion that belongs to the Larson family, one of the founders of the Magic Castle. And Erica Larson and her daughter Liberty have been putting these things on, and used to do it with their mother Irene, who left us too soon, just a few months back, and it's, you know, still her presence is felt. But it's an amazing show where they bring in different variety performers, burlesque acts, anything and everything. You know, you might get, you know, Amazing Jonathan might show up and do something even though he's retired. That's where I saw Puddles the Clown, which was incredible. And they've had some other performers who've been there, including some people from a group, comedy group called Two-Headed Dog, who, you know, I was watching them and I was thinking about something, and they did this sort of, they were the hosts of the show last night. And the premise was that they were actually hosting it as if they were hosting a kind of like a spoof of Playboy After Dark. And it was this sort of, you know, one character was this guy Tellus, who was the impresario of this girly mag empire, you know, who, you know, like, you know, and he, you know, they named off the magazines he has and their, you know, horrific names, you know, and, you know, his partner who helps him run it, you know, they've known since, you know, school, and they're both dressed in 1970s, you know, one's got like the open shirt, the other one's got this tuxedo that is, it could be a TV test pattern. It was for black and white. It's just insane. And they would do their bits and then talk, have a little bit of business and stuff back and forth, you know, about, you know, as the show goes on. And I've seen them before. And what, one of the things I loved about watching them is that they're doing these characters that are very entertaining characters. And, you know, the Tellus character is kind of this, you know, it's just, you know, he's like, talks about like learning, figuring out how to be a fatherhood. Cause you know, he's had like three children and two of them have killed themselves.
Oh, Jesus. You know? Jesus.
You know, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, that sort of thing. And then, you know, they have an entertainer who comes on, a girl to go sing. And, you know, it turns out that she and Tellus had some sort of fling and he was uncomfortable to see her there and involved penicillin. You know, anyhow, that my point is, when watching them and thinking about what makes really great comedy and really great acting and great storytelling is the utter conviction. And as I watch them on stage, I believe them. I believe when they look around, I believe when they look over there and they see something that is very real. There's a consistency there for them, even though you can look and you don't see that it's there. And that's kind of the magic of really good theater. You know, this is nothing new, but it's just this very interesting concept, though, to think is in magic. I think about sometimes one of the problems as I, as a magician or other magicians, is that we don't believe our own world. We don't believe the world that we're inviting people to be into. And that doesn't have to mean that, you know, oh, magic's real, but that what we're doing takes skill, or that we belong in here, or this thing is important or whatever. And I think that's sometimes a failing of a lot of art, is there's a lack of conviction.
Well, it's tough too, because historically, I would say the vast majority of all magic shows I've ever seen, people have been playing some version of themselves, right? Almost never do. you do get a few, you know, very out there characters, but I think that most of us are like, well, you know, it's pretty much me, only a more affable, clever version, you know, and part of that is that you want to wear your cleverness on your sleeve, which I do think it's interesting. You have fantastic magicians like, you know, the slightly tipsy Cardini, you know, who was very much playing a character. And even though the stuff he was doing was very, very difficult, the character he played didn't know anything was difficult. He was busy being surprised by everything.
I mean, that's a very interesting observation that you're wearing your cleverness on your sleeve. And I think as somebody who had a great character was Doug Henning. And Doug Henning was certainly a guy that believed, you know, later on in life that magic was real. But he knew how his tricks worked. But his character could take all these methods and things like this and put it into this umbrella of magic. You know, this idea of magic that the universe can surprise you and sometimes you don't know how it works and it can amaze you. And I think that was kind of part of the charm of it, was that he didn't ask you to believe that it was really magic, but that the idea that magic was this, he didn't just look at it, well, it's not just the fact that I know the cards are marked, but it's the idea that I can have marked cards and that can create this wonder. And the wonder is the world that I live in, that space that we're all going, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And I think that, you know, he's a neat example of somebody who, going from, let's say, Doug Henning to somebody like Pee Wee Herman, who had, you know, a talking couch, talking chairs and things like that. But all of them, you know, Doug Henning inhabited our world, but his world was his way of looking at the world he sold us on.
Well, yeah, and Pee Wee Herman's such a great example, too, because, you know, he had to be our... He had to like kind of like the frequency of the Pee Wee Herman show, you know, was so bizarre and so weird and so surreal. And yet he was still our avatar within it, being a character very much of this universe, which just shows you how much before anybody even opens their mouth, you have to believe that everybody belongs.
Yeah. And I wrestle with it as a magician is the idea of that I want to be sincere, but the moment that I'm playing a role, I don't feel that I'm sincere. And finding that right balance between, let me create this real world for you, but let me still be a real person. Let me create this fictionary world for you, but let me be a real person.
I think it's complicated by the fact that so much of magic is interactive. If you're getting a volunteer up from the audience, it's easier if you're playing a version of yourself to know how to handle anything off script that they do. But if you're playing a character or playing a you know, what feels like a disingenuous or not even disingenuous, just the increased difficulty of playing somebody who doesn't know what it's the curse of knowledge is what it is. Like no matter if you're up there executing the illusions, you cannot, it's very difficult to imagine what it's like to not know what you know. And that's one of the things I deal with Scam School all the time, is every time we do anything that involves a card force, and we try to teach very basic, easy card forces, because certain number of the audience already knows that card force, they come in being all like, cool trick, but dumbest force ever. Couldn't you pick a better force? When what they're really saying is like, I'm already familiar with that force, and I'm assuming a whole bunch of other people are, and I'm uncomfortable and nervous and not confident about doing that force because I don't know how to handle it if somebody knows what I'm up to. It's really just a lack of confidence in themselves that they're expressing. And so it's like, look, man, that's the curse of knowledge, and it's the bane of the existence of all magicians. You have to project yourself to a place where you assume people don't know what you know and tell the story appropriately.
Well, also with character work, you know, there was a really interesting thing that I got from an episode of Harmontown, where they were talking about acting class and specifically one exercise where you had to go with other people to the airport. And then while the one person was sitting far away, the buddy would go up to a random person and just say, hey, could you go ahead and look at my friend? We're doing this acting thing. Just tell me what you think about him, just looking at him or her. And then they would just get random people to say, oh, well, they look trustworthy. They look shady. They look this, that, and the other. And then if you do it enough, you tend to see little through lines of what, on average, a random person would think of you. Now, this is, and the comedy of that podcast was them kind of going through the trauma of finding out what other people think of you when they look at you. But it really, to me, says a lot about
character. Because at the end of the day, we don't get the final decision on how we are perceived. We can shape it. We can make it easier to make people perceive us in a certain way. But no matter what, that's kind of up to the populace. And that's up to your audience. And you cannot get inside their heads and make them think about you exactly the way that you want them to. And the best characters are the ones where so much is being done beyond the costume, beyond the voice, beyond the patter. You know, there is something that kind of brings you in to the entire experience. And that's really, to me, where the best, like the top tier characters kind of come from, is just that idea of you walk in, you take a look at somebody and you're like, okay, I think I know where this is. Then they open their mouth and it confirms it.
It's a very hard sort of lesson to get over. Man, what a hell of an exercise to go do that. And, you know, we'd see that in magic a lot where, you know, particularly when David Copperfield was, you know, on his ascendancy, was you would see so many magicians try to dress like him and act like him, and trying to people who are not svelte, you know, guys dressing like, and it just, they looked like you become a parody without realizing it, you know, and it becomes very, very problematic, you know, when you're trying to emulate something that's so clearly not what you are. You look like a Will Ferrell sketch, but you don't know it.
Yeah. Well, and Copperfield's a great example, right? Because if you track him in his ascendancy, even now, you go see David Copperfield now, and very much what he wears on his sleeve is, these are my ideas, these are my inspirations. And him as a person, he's a slight kid from the suburbs in New Jersey, right? And you're like, okay, well, how could this person become the most charismatic magician on the planet? And it's like, okay, if his ideas took him far, right? His ideas can make him more than what he would be normally. And that's been his brand forever and is still his brand. And it's successful, I think, because part of it just reads. I mean, now he's, you know, a celebrity who does celebrity things. And
well, but even then, he's learned how to adjust his character as, you go from playing the plucky kid to somebody who has an extraordinary, I mean, he sat atop the throne and still does sit atop the throne in so many different ways. But there's a humility to him now that's more appropriate for somebody who has done what he's done that maybe made less sense with somebody who was on the rise as he was in the 1980s.
Somebody asked in the chat room, have I seen what Night Attack did to his Grand Canyon flight?
We did not. It was a funny little thing we did of just Bonnie Tyler and David. Imagining that if David Copperfield were recording a Blu-ray commentary track, that maybe things got amorous between him and Bonnie Tyler at the top.
I've actually known some behind the scenes stories about that.
Watching it again, it's so amazing because the illusion so holds up. It's a great illusion, and it's visually a real treat. And I would imagine at the time, I guess I was too young to I didn't watch it, I guess, but it's pretty stunning. But it does also have that leisurely early 80s pacing where, well, the song is, 4 minutes, 20 seconds long. So I guess the illusion needs to be 4 minutes, 20 seconds long. And you get kind of a lot of time to think about, wow, man, he's really floating. There.
Yeah, that was interesting in that period you had, first starting in the 1970s, when Doug Henning put magic on television in a big way. Doug Henning was so worried about the credibility of magic that he decided he would do his TV specials live. And you can go back and see some Doug Henning TV specials, and if you watch closely, you can see the problems of sometimes when you do things live, particularly magic. There were a couple screw-ups and things like that. And when David Copperfield went to go do his specials, he'd figured, you know what? Live to tape is pretty good. You know what? Because it's not like we're going to go do it, you know, live, you know, on the West Coast or, you know, East Coast, then do it again on the, you know, West Coast. We're going to record it. And so might as well just do live to tape. And so, but within live to tape, he said, okay, if we're doing live to tape, then we still got to have rules we follow. And, you know, the rules are that if you're where the camera was, then what you're seeing is exactly what you would see. So when he did his Grand Canyon special, you know, that's an example of that, where it was like, okay, we're going to follow this rule. And you think about – So for those of you who don't know, what this was is David Copperfield made a Learjet disappear. He made the Statue of Liberty disappear. And then what? And then he decided he was going to levitate over the Grand Canyon. And for the, if you think about the production of that, forget the trick. The production of that, where you've got to actually have helicopter camera, you've got to be able to film something on one side of the Grand Canyon, go across the Grand Canyon, so he's flying across the Grand Canyon, and then land on the other side and have this continuous sort of thing. The production element of alone is incredible. And then when you realize, and there are people who are like, oh, I know how this works. It's like, well, but do you? Because he's here and now he's over here.
Yeah.
You know? And that alone, it, I mean, it was a, I would say, as a magic trick, it didn't succeed in sort of the ways the other ones did, as far as, you know,
capturing the public's imagination, or
precisely, yes. I would say if you look at it from a, and I've talked about this with magicians, I go, I'm like, yeah, but look what they did technically. Look what really what happened here. Not just what the thing was, but how they pulled this off. Effing amazing.
Yeah.
Really, really amazing.
No, it holds up. For whatever reason, that's one I never investigated or found out. Like, I looking at it, I'm like, yeah, I got some guesses, but they're probably all wrong.
When he did the walking through the Great Wall of China, you know, that was another thing where logistically everything that went into play for that was very, very, you know, you talked about in the last, in weird things, you talk about, you know, constraints being something that can actually be an asset. And that's very frequent in magic, as we say, we have to work with a certain number of things. And once you narrow it down, you can focus your creativity in one path and come up with some really, really great ideas when you're not trying to reinvent the world.
Yeah, and there is, especially in magic, there's a functionality to certain aspects of it. There's I guess, I don't know, a good enoughness. And I think we've talked about this before on the show, but so many people have a fantastic version of their show in their mind with production values and so on as they practice in their living room, and then they enter a magic competition and get up and try to do what they did in their living room for the first time with the actual music on an actual stage. And they a billion of those little things, like, oh, I don't realize it takes 15 seconds longer to wait for a person to come up on stage than I had expected it to. And as a result, there's this weird, herky-jerky rhythm to everything. And it even matters, like, whether or not the stage has a apron with stairs right in the front or stairs off to the side. And, you know, you realize, oh, for the first time ever, I have to communicate effectively to the sound person the exact cue that they need to hit. Otherwise, the timing for the trick is all the way screwed up.
I saw Justin Willman and Dan Sperry at the Magic Castle this week, and it was fantastic. And Justin Willman used to be Justin Incredible, somebody we've known, you know, for years, is watching the evolution of that and how there are the things that scare me as a performer. It's not like, oh, can I do the trick? Yeah, but it's all the beats in between when it comes going back into stage performing of, okay, I got to get this person from the audience. I've got to get them up stage, and I've got to do this. And if I'm not clear in my instructions, what should take 12 seconds will take 45 seconds. And like you pointed out, it becomes a drag. And those are the things that, you know, it's why I get asked, like, oh, when are you going to go perform there again? I'm like, there's so many little things that have to be workshopped within a magic trick. It's not just the effect, but it's the staging and all that other stuff. And when you watch performers like you or Justin, who are just so, you know, well-oiled machines, and understanding that and knowing and being three steps ahead from the moment you say, hey, come on up here and help me with this, or when you're doing this thing, to know where it's going to go.
And it's not even just magic stuff too. It's like, if you want to set up, like, there's a joke gag where it's a fairly old one. You probably know the origins of it, but it's basically, you're like, hey, you have something that says psychic prediction. You ask, do you know what I've written on the back of this card? They say no. You flip it around and show that it's the word no. You got to be very careful about how you set everything up and until that moment. And there are things you have to say and do that cause people to only have one reaction that makes sense. You know, you don't say, hey, what do you think I've written on the other side of this card? You know, or instead you give them a job. You're like, I need you to think of any word. Do you have a word? Excellent. Before the show, I wrote on the back of this card. Just to be clear, do you happen to know what I've written on the back of this card. Close your eyes, turn your face, hold your hand up to your ear so they can't shake their head. They know I haven't said that they need to say something out loud, but I've indicated that they need to say it loud because I've held a hand up to my ear. I've closed my eyes so I can't see them shaking their head or whatever. So there's only one thing that makes sense to do, and that's say the word no. But even then, people don't always say the word no, in which case you have to be ready to make this a moment and go in another direction, have something for it.
Yeah, all those little moments, all those little things, that's the work of it. You know, I was talking about an idea for a magic show with Justin. It's like, man, it's a great idea, but like to get it from my head to in front of people is...
That's a project, and that's a good idea too, but like it is, especially that, like that is ornate in terms of workshopping. There's a lot of rough edges that just, and that's not to say, you know, that it is a mark that an idea is good or bad. Like it's just, you know, it's a busy idea. You know, you just got to figure out. You got to run a few of those tokens down the Plinko machine and find out which ones, you know, go left and which ones go right.
And that gets back to our whole, you know, talk about find a place to fail, find a place where you can screw up, find a place where it's okay to not have it be perfect, you know. And that's the mistake that we often talk about is people want, you know, the first, you know, like this idea is a cool idea, but the worst thing in the world I could do would be like, hey, I'm going to go do this in the most public place I can to go do it, because the idea might be great, but you won't know it because of all the things that won't work the first. You won't know what you don't need to know, you know, and that's the hard part is you don't know until you do that. And so when I got out of doing illusions years ago, after I did a tour of Japan, I was sick of doing stage magic, you know, the big illusion stuff, because I didn't feel it was like unique enough. I gave away all my props and I actually spent a couple of years not doing magic. And then I wanted to go do stuff and I wasn't sure. And then finally somebody said, hey, I work with a theater group or a sketch comedy group. Would you want to do 10 minutes in front of it? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. And everything's kind of rough. They're like, no, it's just these people don't, you know, people are there to see sketch comedy. Trust me. You know, their concept of entertainment is going to be very different than a cruise ship audience or whatever. And yeah, that was a great place to just go play with character and go do stuff and then find out, you know, who I was on stage, who I wanted to be on stage. And, you know, then just took it around to different kind of places where I could workshop it. And that helped me evolve a lot. It wasn't something I could ever have done in the places where I was getting paid to do, but I found places where it was okay to fail.
Dude, and that's so important. We've talked about this before. Like, it's so important. And I guess also that was a place where you reduced the number of possible outcomes that could be even labeled failure. In a cruise ship, there's a lot of ways you could fail.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you could give the appearance that you aren't polished enough. You could make people regret that they're watching your show, not hanging out at the buffet, because that's the other thing is this, they're all like, I spent $5,000 on this trip. I am judging every moment of my experience and I want to feel like I'm getting the maximum value at this moment.
You could accidentally let your mountain lion loose in the middle of your show. That's another way to fail on a cruise ship.
But the point is that by entering a situation in which stuff is already experimental and everybody's there to see surprising stuff possibly go off the rails and so on, then all of a sudden the number of ways to truly fail become virtually none. You know, as long as people aren't actively angry and throwing things at you, and even then, maybe that's not failure. Maybe that's a good way to figure out what causes people to get angry and throw stuff at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was some of the stuff. You go back and you watch like Andy Kaufman and you watch, you know, some kind of out there sort of comedy, and you realize that, yeah, his goal was something very different. It wasn't to go in and like, hey, I'm going to just tell you a bunch of jokes and you're going to laugh. It's like, can I get them to hate me? You know, can I get them to hate me?
Can I get them to hate me and then turn around again? You know, it's mm-hmm. like it's not always that next level manipulation.
Yeah, and that's a... You know, and that's having a different value set. That's playing a different game than everybody else is playing.
Yeah. You know, we were, when I was in LA last weekend, Andrew and I and John were watching a couple performers that were just fantastic. One is I guess a guy who's on America's Got Talent now, Tape Face. And the other, who is the name of the juggler?
Oh, Michael Rayner. Michael Rayner.
Michael Rayner. And both of them, like, just you want, you know, and it's funny because one's silent and one's not, both of them, you have their entire character. It's right there. And when they open their mouth and all their bits click into what their strengths are, it's just so remarkable to see when the character triumphs, right? Like when it all is working together.
Yeah, that evolution's interesting because Michael Rayner, you should look him up. He's a hilarious guy. And I know a lot of jugglers. Jugglers are fine. I have no problem with juggling. Juggling gets to be extremely redundant because they all do sort of the same sort of stunts. And then even worse than magic in some degree. But then what happens is some of them either, they become really, really hilarious. They become really good stand-up comedians who are using juggling as sort of their medium. In Michael Rayner's case, it's just his character is so – he's such a funny guy, and he's very real. He's very, very real, and you would watch him do anything, even if it didn't involve juggling. You would watch him, what's funny is I am in that photo.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm right.
That's you partially obscured?
Yep, that's me right behind him.
Oh,
yep,
that's
yep.
Amazing. Where is that?
That was at the Magic Con.
That's funny.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Is that Danny?
Yeah.
That's funny.
So Danny, there's a photo of Michael Rayner balancing a shoe on his nose. So he does this bit where he basically says, he pulls out a $5 bill or a $20 bill, depends on what the gig pays him, I guess. And he says, I can balance anybody's shoe on my nose for 7 seconds. And people start throwing shoes on stage. And it's not just the fact that he's balancing a shoe on his nose. It's his interaction with the audience, his commentary. He picks up the shoes and he's just so brilliant and off the cuff with, what he's able to do. And again, he's, experienced, affords him the ability to always have something to say and be able to do that. But, and then his interactions are just so, so delightful.
He uses the shoes as kind of this great sort of like crowd work with a purpose, a kind of moment to just, because you can rip on somebody's shoes, right? And use them as a window into their personality, and yet not necessarily hurt their feelings, right? But it's just so great.
Well, especially when they're not subject to having everyone stare at them as they're being ripped on, because I assume all the shoes are fairly anonymous. You have that curtain.
Yeah, there was the one clip that I saw is him at the Magic Castle. He has one a flat woman's shoe, and then this like crazy high heel strappy woman shoe, and just goes on and on about how like let me guess, that with the flat shoe you're married and you're not.
That's great.
Just kills.
Michael Rayner's wife is Moira Quirk, who you remember from Nickelodeon,
from Guts. She's throwing to Mo, dude, come on, do you have it? Guts, the Astro Craig, throw it to Mo. No? All right. Somebody listening to this is really excited. as I was.
It really is like you just started speaking in tongues to me. Man. That was amazing.
Oh, dude. Oh,
trust me. I've been around him and his wife when people, young people, let's say maybe a younger generation, Brian.
Sure, sure.
See her and get excited. So
She was the timekeeper and referee for the Kids American Gladiators series, Guts. But yeah, she kept it by the numbers.
Yeah,
she's fair and honest.
A lot of voiceover work too. She's very, very talented. I think it's worth seeing when people can do their own sort of personas. When that becomes very real and you feel it's consistent, then that's cool. Any picks?
Let me be the dumbest person on earth and just let everybody know that I had this wild idea. I was having a very productive Friday and I was like, oh man, you want to know what? Whenever I log in to the Contender MailChimp account, I always realize that we have a Night Attack MailChimp and we probably haven't used it since probably the last album.
Yeah.
That we put out. And so I'm like, well, I pay for this. Like, what if I just used it to blast for the stickers or DIAF store? as it turns out, man, this like mailing list thing, I think there's something to it.
It turns out it's a pretty good deal. Being able to track how many people open things and whether or not they read them, what people respond to, A-B testing for different subject lines.
Yeah, I didn't even do that, man. You're at that next level. Like, I'm like... I'm just like showing up to school and saying like, oh, wow, look, huh, you can learn things. Like you're over there in AP chemistry doing, you know, really great stuff. So, yeah, I just wrote up this little thing as Captain Morgan. And yeah, no, I think we sold more in a day than we had sold before. So
well, and I think the reason this works so well is, number one, of course, everybody, you know, everyone buys stickers from Justin. You're helping to support him being an independent podcaster. But more importantly, I think it's the fact that this thing, yes, is a reminder that you do stickers or DIAF and you sell sticker packs. But more importantly, it is standalone content that was funny to read from beginning to end. Everybody reading it read it in the Captain Morgan voice the entire way through. And I think it was really good.
Yeah, well, thank you for complimenting the writing. You know, it was definitely one of those, like, you know, I've probably said things like, yeah, mailing list is the way to go. That's the way to steadily make a living on the internet. And, I had never really tried it for a product of mine before. Turns out it's pretty good.
Who knew? Who knew?
Who knew? Aside from both of you and literally every other business professional.
And literally yourself. Like, who knew? Yeah. Apparently I did when I told everyone.
I mean, that's the thing, is there's things we know intellectually, then there are things we know emotionally. And we're, you know, there's that, all that sort of knowledge that just sort of sits there, but then the things we don't necessarily act on. And I can sit there and go, man, it'd be a really good idea if I did blank. Yeah. Great. It's like Dumb and Dumber, the Hawaiian Tropic bus.
Exactly. No, I mean, there's a million of those little things. And part of it is life gets in the way. And part of it is, you know, when you try to keep a busy schedule, like things can slide off or you can give yourself permission to not do it. But that was definitely one of those like, oh, geez. Yeah. Kind of dumb for not doing that before. Good thing I've learned now.
Hey, I have an idea. Let's do picks because it kind of segues in. One of the things that is that I listen to that is filled with a bunch of case studies of advertising campaigns in the past. I the pacing on it is a little bit fatty, but I think that's just because it's a CBC radio program. But if you just, you know, just sort of the moment I hit start, I just hit 30-second skip three times, and then if you start it at 90 seconds in, it's a very punchy, very well-written radio broadcast about advertising and about all these amazing – it's from a former ad man, talks about the nature of writing, and he collects these amazing stories, and it's where I learned about that book, A Beautiful Constraint, because he did his – once a year, he does this roundup, he calls it bookmarks, of all the stuff that he couldn't quite make full stories out of, but are from the various books that he had, you know, that he's bookmarked and took away from. And he made a big, told a great story about how Stephen King first sold the paperback rights to, publishing rights to the paperback for Carrie, and how it was a profoundly life-changing event and on writing and so on. But the show is called Under the Influence. And it's really, really good. I like it.
Awesome.
Sounds cool.
With Terry O'Reilly. That's the guy's name. He's got one of those. It's a very radio-y kind of voice. I don't know if you can play just a snippet of it, but he always talks.
Very Canadian head.
He always talks like he's on the radio.
Casey Kasem.
Yeah, very Casey Kasem-y. You probably get... look, you're looking at 90 seconds of intro here.
Thus started one of the most famous rituals in our culture, the singing of the national anthem at sporting events.
So anyway, I listened to it at like 1.25 speed, and it's real punchy. I like it.
Well, Brian, that's a great suggestion you have there. How about you, Justin? Anything you'd like to throw out there?
Thank you, Andrew. When I think about what I want to throw out there... a VR game. It's called Selfie Tennis. You play tennis against yourself. Do you not have a VR? I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know. There's really not much more. I like it. It's fun.
I mean, I guess you could live in reality. I don't see why.
God, I didn't realize you could beat up all the spectators. All of a sudden, this game got so much better to me. I think Penny's just been playing it just to play it regular.
Oh, wow. Look. Oh, I didn't realize you could throw the racket. That's smart, too.
Sorry. Welcome to our new podcast, Watching the Trailer for Selfie Tennis.
Yeah, it looks beautiful. Looks great. I have a recommendation. Pardon me.
Audio listeners, you just got to see the rolling of Andrew Main and the return thereof.
Great book. If you're looking to start a business and you want to learn about putting together pitch decks, a lot of other things, it's called Get Backed, and it's by Evan Baer and Evan Loomis. And it is filled with great, great advice, examples of what pitch decks look like. It goes through, explains a lot of that stuff where you read, like, when you read some of these things, I just assume you know what a lot of these terms mean. In here, they actually break it down and explain it to you. It was put out by, I believe, Harvard Press, Harvard Business Review Press. Highly, highly recommended. If you're looking to do a business or something, Get Backed. Really, really, really well worth it. So one of the things, like the first 20 pages, I'm like, oh, this makes so much sense. I wish somebody explained this to me. So
that's great.
Nice.
It's been after.
It has been. Hooray!
It's been after.
All the way to the max.
To the max.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.